Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
You know, when we think about how our bodies are built, we almost always default to DNA, right?
Right, yeah. It's like the classic textbook answer.
Exactly. We treat it as this ultimate, unchangeable architectural blueprint. But there's actually a biological reality operating inside you right now that makes that blueprint analogy feel, well, completely inadequate.
It really does.
Because over half of all the proteins functioning in your body at this very moment, they're heavily modified. They're covered and decorated by these really complex microscopic sugar structures. Mm-hmm. And we call these structures glycans.
Yeah, and it is a spectacularly intricate system. Like, to be clear for the listeners, we aren't talking about the simple glucose your body burns for energy.
Right, not the sugar you stir into your morning coffee.
Exactly, no. These glycans are highly branched, three-dimensional carbohydrate trees, basically, and they are physically bolted onto the exterior of your proteins, which is wild. And this brings us to the massive biological loophole that we are doing a deep dive on today. Your DNA directly codes for those underlying proteins, right? Like, it provides the exact sequence of amino acids needed to build them.
Yes, that's a traditional blueprint.
But your DNA does not contain a direct sequential code for those crucial sugar coatings.
No, it doesn't at all.
So let's stick with the house analogy for a second. If your DNA is the architectural blueprint of a house, detailing exactly where every wall, door, and window goes, these glycans are the daily weather.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
They're the humidity, you know, the torrential rain, the scorching summer sun. The blueprint itself doesn't dictate the weather, but the weather absolutely determines whether the wood rots or how the paint peels.
Right. It dictates how that house actually functions over time.
Mm.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. I mean, the underlying protein structure might be perfectly sound according to the DNA blueprint, but if the sugar coating weather is too harsh, the protein will just fail.
And that presents a really profound scientific mystery. I mean, if your genes don't have a direct code for these sugars, how on earth does your body control them?
Are they just, you know, randomly attaching to things?
Yeah, exactly. And more importantly, what happens to your actual day-to-day health when this delicate sugar coating process starts behaving erratically?
Well, those are the exact questions we have some truly groundbreaking answers to today, thanks to an immense and honestly highly coordinated international collaborative effort.
Yes, absolutely. Today we celebrate the work of Sadbo Sharapov, Yuri S. Alchenko, and a massive international consortium of researchers who have advanced our understanding of the genetics behind our blood's sugar coatings.
Yeah, this deep dive is based on a landmark study which was published online in Nature Communications on July 1st, 2025.
Right.
And the research is titled, A Genome-Wide Association Study in 10,000 Individuals Links Plasma and Glycum to Liver Disease and Anti-Inflammatory Proteins.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we get into the massive scale of that study, we need to establish some baseline context. The specific biological process they are looking at is called N-glycosylation.
Yes. N-glycosylation.
What does that actually mean for the proteins floating around in our blood?
So N-glycosylation, it's a highly specific type of protein modification. The N simply refers to the amino acid asparagine.
Okay, got it.
As a newly minted protein is being folded inside a cell, specialized cellular machinery basically covalently links these complex sugar polymers, the glycans, to specific asparagine sites right on the protein's surface.
So they're physically snapping them onto the outside.
Exactly. And in the human bloodstream, the vast majority of these sugar-coated proteins are being synthesized and secreted by just two main sources. You can think of them as the two primary manufacturing plants in the body.
Okay, what are the plants?
First, your liver, which handles metabolic proteins. And second, your lymphoid tissues.
Like the immune system.
Right, specifically the B cells of your immune system, which pump out antibodies.
Okay, so the liver and the immune system are the twin factories supplying the blood with these modified proteins. But you mentioned earlier that if the weather is bad, the house degrades. Why are these sugar trees so critical to our overall health?
Well, because they fundamentally alter both the physical shape and the chemical behavior of the proteins they are attached to.
Oh, wow. So they change how the protein actually works.
Completely. They dictate how long a protein survives in the bloodstream before being broken down, or say how well an antibody binds to a virus, or even how efficiently a metabolic protein transports fat.
That is huge.
Yeah. We've known from clinical observations for decades that abnormal glycosylation is strongly linked to the rise of cardiometabolic diseases, severe immune disorders, and liver diseases.
So when the sugar coatings go wrong, human health deteriorates pretty rapidly.
It really does, yeah.
Which brings us to the historical problem here. Up until very recently, exactly how our genetics regulate this whole sugar coating process in living humans has been, well, essentially a biological black box.
Oh, a total black box.
Like, if you sequence my DNA today, you can't just point to a line of genetic code and say, ah, here is the exact 3D blueprint for this specific sugar tree on this specific antibody.
You cannot. And that has been a massive hurdle for geneticists. The genome simply does not contain a direct template for the final glycan structure.
But wait, then how does it get built?
Well, it does code for all the machinery that builds those structures. So your DNA provides the instructions for the enzymes.
Oh, okay. The worker.
Right, the glycosyl transferases that act like assembly line workers adding individual sugar molecules, and the glycosidases that act like quality control workers snipping sugars away.
So the DNA also codes for the raw materials, the cellular transporters, the regulatory proteins, all of that.
Exactly. All the factory parts.
Okay, so we can't look for the blueprint of the weather itself, but we can look for the factory managers. We can hunt for the genes that control the thermostats, the assembly lines, and the raw material shipments.
Yes, that is the core methodology of this study. The researchers wanted to find those genetic managers, and to do it, they conducted the largest genome-wide association meta-analysis, or QAMA, of the blood plasma N-glycome ever attempted.
That sounds massive.
It was. They analyzed data from roughly 10,000 individuals of mostly European descent, pulling from 7 different participating cohorts across 6 countries.
Now, a 10,000-person study might not sound immediately mind-blowing to everyone, especially when we constantly hear about DNA databases with millions of people, but reading DNA is relatively easy and cheap now, right?
Right. Standard sequencing is very streamlined today.
But measuring these microscopic 3D sugar structures in the blood of a field called glycomics, that's a totally different beast, isn't it?
Oh, it is incredibly complex and resource intensive compared to standard DNA sequencing.
Yeah.
You aren't just reading a linear alphabet of 4 letters.
Right.
You have to physically separate the plasma proteins, chemically cleave the glycans off of them, and then use highly sensitive mass spectrometry to figure out the exact 3-dimensional branching structure.
And the abundance of those sugars too, right?
Exactly. It is an arduous biochemical process.
And they didn't just measure one or two things, which is what's so crazy. They analyzed 117 different N-glycome traits.
Yeah, a huge amount of data.
That included 36 directly measured glycan structures and 81 derived traits that reflect the broader complex pathways of how these sugars are built in the factory.
But you know, what elevates this study from just a simple observational data set into a true landmark is how they hunted for the causal genes, the real managers of these factories.
How did they do that without getting lost in the noise?
They integrated 8 different predictors into a massive consensus model. So they layered proteomics, which measures actual protein levels. They brought in transcriptomics to see how actively genes are being turned on or off.
Oh, okay, so layering different kinds of biological evidence.
Right. They cross-referenced known genetic mutations that cause severe congenital disorders of glycosylation. They layered all of this biological evidence on top of the genetic association data to prioritize the most likely causal genes.
So they threw every statistical tool in the toolbox at this to ensure they weren't just finding random correlations.
Exactly. They wanted cause and effect.
And that leads to a technique they use to connect these genetic findings to actual real-world diseases in a database of 450,000 people from the UK Biobank. It's called Mendelian randomization.
Yes.
Yes.
A very powerful tool.
I see this term pop up constantly in modern genetics deep dives. How does it actually prove cause and effect without, you know, putting people in a clinical trial?
It is an incredibly clever statistical method that treats nature itself as a randomized controlled trial.
Okay, how so?
Imagine a traditional drug trial. You randomly assign one group of people to take a cholesterol-lowering pill and another group gets a placebo. You track them for 10 years to see who gets heart disease.
Right, standard medical trial.
Mendelian randomization does the same thing, but instead of a pill, it uses your genes. Because your genes are randomly shuffled and assigned at the moment of conception, and they generally do not change throughout your life.
Oh, nature has already randomized the population.
Exactly.
So nature gave one group of people the genetic variant that naturally builds more of a specific sugar structure, and gave another group the variant that builds less.
Yes. So if the group that inherited the genetic variant for building more of a specific glycan also has a significantly higher rate of a specific disease, say, liver disease, it provides incredibly strong mathematical evidence that the glycan change is actively causing or driving the disease.
Rather than just being an innocent bystander or a side effect, it separates the causal trigger from a mere correlation. That is brilliant.
It really is.
So they essentially use this 10,000 person glycan dataset as a decoding ring, and then applied it to 500,000 people in the UK biobank to see who got sick and why.
Yes, and the results were stunning.
Let's talk about what they actually found. The headline here is that they literally doubled the map of our understanding. They discovered 25 entirely novel genetic regions, or loci, tied to blood and glycosylation.
And within those newly discovered regions, they confidently prioritized 13 entirely new candidate genes that had never before been definitively linked to human protein and glycosylation.
Now, here is where it gets really interesting and where my previous understanding of genetics gets a bit scrambled. Several of these newly prioritized manager genes don't seem to have anything directly to do with building sugars.
Right, they look like they belong to different pathways.
Yeah. I'm looking at the list and a cluster of them, like GCKR, FADS2, TREB1, GRAM-D1B, they are famous for being heavily involved in lipid metabolism. Like, how our bodies process fats and cholesterol.
Which seems counterintuitive at first.
Exactly. Why on earth is a cholesterol-regulating gene managing a sugar factory?
That is the profound realization of this study. It proves that the biological pathways are not siloed. The genetic regulation of these sugar coatings is deeply intrinsically entwined with our fundamental metabolic pathways.
So the fat managers and the sugar managers are the same guys?
Basically, yes. The genes that regulate how your liver handles fats are simultaneously influencing how that same liver decorates its proteins with sugars.
Wow.
And equally important, they found another cluster of these new manager genes like HP, HPR, SERPINL1, and CFH that encode anti-inflammatory proteins, which are heavy hitters in our body's response to tissue damage.
So the genes managing our fat storage and our immune inflammation are also the ones dictating the sugar weather.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, that makes an intuitive kind of sense given how closely obesity, inflammation, and metabolic diseases are linked in the clinic. But there is a massive plot twist in the study regarding how these genes exert their control. It's a completely segregated.
Yes, the tissue segregation is perhaps the most crucial mechanistic insight of the entire paper.
Break that down for us.
Remember, we established that the liver and the immune system's B cells are the two main factories producing these circulating proteins.
Right, the two plants.
The researchers constructed a massive gene network to map the interactions and found that the regulatory network cleanly and strictly splits into two separate subnetworks.
Meaning the managers for the liver factory do not talk to the managers for the immune factory.
Not at all. One network almost exclusively controls the genetic instructions for the glycans attached to proteins made in the liver. The other network completely independently controls the glycans attached to immunoglobulins, the antibodies made by the immune system.
But wait, let me make sure I follow this. Don't both factories use a lot of the same machinery?
They do, yes.
For example, there's a gene called FUT8. It encodes a major enzyme that physically attaches a specific sugar called fucose. That enzyme operates in both liver cells and immune cells, right?
That's correct.
So how can the control be totally segregated if they're using the exact same worker?
That is where the team's colocalization analysis revealed something beautiful. Even for a shared gene like FUT8, the genetic control mechanisms, like the switches that turn the gene up or down, are completely distinct depending on which tissue it resides in.
Are you serious?
Yes. The genetic variants that alter FUT8's activity in the liver have absolutely zero effect on FUT8's activity in the lymphoid tissue, and vice versa.
Okay, let me bring the factory analogy back. It's like having a corporate manager who oversees two entirely different manufacturing buildings, a heavy machinery plant and a delicate electronics plant.
I like this.
It's the exact same manager in charge of both, but the rules, the shift schedules, the safety protocols they enforce are completely different depending on which building they happen to be standing in today.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. And the reason this strict segregation is so important clinically is because it allows us to link specific disease processes to specific tissues through these circulating glycans.
Which brings us to the real-world impact. Using that Mendelian randomization against the UK Biobank data, they looked at high mannose glycans, specifically a structure called M9, which is basically a massive sugar tree with nine mannose sugar molecules on it. And they found this M9 structure is strongly linked to cardiovascular diseases like essential hypertension and ischemic heart disease.
Yes, but the researchers utilized something called bidirectional Mendelian randomization to truly untangle the chicken and egg scenario here.
Hold on, bidirectional? Are we absolutely sure it's not the other way around? Like, how can they confidently say the fat disorder causes the sugar change and not vice versa just by looking at a database?
That is the beauty of doing the analysis in both directions.
Yeah.
First, they looked at people with genetic variants that only increase the M9 glycan. Did those people have more lipid disorders?
Did they?
No. Then they reversed it. They looked at people who had genetic variants known to cause severe lipid and lipoprotein metabolism disorders. Did those people have elevated M9 glycans?
Let me guess, yes.
Yes. The data clearly showed that the underlying metabolic disease is the primary driver.
Wow.
The lipid disorder forces the liver factory into a state of stress, altering its output and causing it to pump out proteins covered in these massive M9 sugar structures.
So the disease changes the weather. That's incredible. But then they found the exact opposite mechanism when looking at respiratory diseases, didn't they?
They did.
They found that an increase in a different glycan, M6, actually causes a higher risk of asthma. How does a microscopic sugar tree on a protein circulating in your blood physically cause someone to develop asthma? What is the physical mechanism there?
It comes down to the shape and behavior of antibodies. Mm-hmm. Elevated M6 glycans are very prominent on IgE antibodies.
Okay.
And IgE antibodies are the primary watchdogs of the immune system when it comes to allergic reactions. Picture the antibody as a Y-shaped protein. The glycans sit right in the hinge region of that Y.
Right, and then oh.
Exactly. If your genetics dictate that your immune factory builds more of the specific M6 sugar structure in that hinge, it physically forces the antibody into a more open, rigid conformation.
It changes the physical geometry of the weapon?
Exactly. It acts like a hair trigger. It makes the antibody hyperreactive. So when a relatively harmless particle, like a pollen grain, enters the airway, boom. That hyperreactive, structurally altered IgE antibody triggers an explosive, massive release of histamine and inflammatory chemicals, leading to the airway constriction we recognize as asthma.
So the genetic propensity to build that specific sugar directly causes the disease pathology.
You've got it.
The DNA pulls the string, the factory builds a rigid sugar hinge, the antibody becomes a hair trigger, and the patient gets asthma. That is a stunning causal chain.
It really is a triumph of modern genetics.
So if I'm a physician or even just someone keeping an eye on my metabolic health, you know, why should I care about these specific genetic links?
You should care because this establishes a definitive mechanistic bridge between your foundational genetics and your risk for complex metabolic diseases, particularly in the liver.
Give me an example.
For instance, this study showed that common genetic variations that predispose someone to metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, what used to be called fatty liver disease, are the exact same genetic variations controlling the abundance of these liver-secreted glycans.
Which means we can potentially see the disease manifesting in the blood long before the liver actually fails.
Precisely.
And the researchers pointed to a very specific biomarker for this. They identified a glycan structure known as A3G3S3, which was strongly associated with levels of AST.
Yes.
Now, AST is a classic liver enzyme. When liver cells are dying or injured, they burst open and AST spikes in the blood. But what is an A3G3S3? That sounds like a droid from Star Wars.
It does sound like a droid, yeah. It refers to the chemical composition of the glycan branch. The crucial part of that acronym is the S3, which means it is tricyylated.
Tricyylated, okay.
It has three sialic acid molecules capping the ends of its sugar branches. And sialic acid is fundamentally important because it carries a strong negative electrical charge.
Oh, I see. So having three of them on a protein is like attaching three strong negative magnets to it. That has to drastically change how the protein repels or attracts other molecules in the bloodstream.
It completely changes its biological behavior. And what the researchers found is that measuring the levels of this specific highly charged sugar coating in the blood could serve as an incredibly sensitive early biomarker for liver pathogenesis.
So sticking with our factory analogy, instead of just waiting to see if the manufacturing plant catches on fire and burns to the ground, which is essentially what waiting for AST to spike means, we can actively inspect the specific chemical makeup of the exhaust fumes coming out of the chimney.
Right.
We can look at the glycans to see the microscopic stress the liver is under before the massive damage occurs.
That is the promise of this research, absolutely. Mm-hmm. However, scientific rigor demands we acknowledge the limitations the authors themselves highlighted.
Of course. What's the catch?
The primary limitation of this massive guama is that they analyzed bulk plasma.
Meaning they took a sample of blood and just looked at the entire soup of all the glycans attached to all the millions of proteins simultaneously.
Yes. They didn't separate the proteins first. It is an aggregate measurement.
It's like standing outside a massive football stadium and recording the audio. You hear the roar of the crowd, and you can tell if the home team is winning or losing based on the volume, but you can't hear any individual conversations.
A perfect analogy. While this study is a monumental leap forward in understanding the genetic architecture, the next crucial step for the field is to study the N-glycosylation of purified individual proteins.
So zooming in on specific conversations.
Exactly. Researchers need to isolate specific immunoglobulins, or specific liver transport proteins like transferrin, and look exclusively at their individual sugar coatings. That will cut through the noise of the stadium and provide an even sharper, higher resolution picture of the genetic regulation.
Makes total sense. So bringing all of this together, the central insight of this deep dive is a paradigm shift in how we view our biology.
It really is.
The complex sugar coatings decorating the proteins in your blood are not random happenstance. They are tightly, uniquely controlled by your genetics, and that control is strictly segregated by the specific tissue factory, whether it's the liver or the immune system where the protein is manufactured.
Right.
This genetic regulation acts as a vital, active bridge between your foundational DNA blueprint and your real-world risk for complex metabolic, liver, and respiratory diseases.
And that profound reality leaves us with a fascinating question for the future of personalized medicine.
What's that?
Well, imagine a future where your routine blood test doesn't just measure your cholesterol, but reads the specific microscopic sugar trees growing on your proteins to predict an illness before you even feel a symptom. What does this mean for the future of personalized medicine?
That is something to think about. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base. Midnight in the lab, bright screen, steady glow, 10,000 lives and numbers lit, pattern show. Little sugar branches dancing on the proteins we know. A secret map in plasma where the quiet currents flow. Every peak a clue, every shift a sign. Genes pull the strings and networks, crossing every line from liver made to immune made. The signals realign. Read the sugar codes. Name candidate.
nothing like the way.